This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. I'm Dan Clark. Thank you for tuning in or downloading. If you do download this show, by the way, please tell your friends about the show. Get them to tune in to FUBARradio.com on Fridays at 12. Or please, you know, tell them about the podcast on iTunes or wherever. And rate the show and, you know, spread the word. Just a little reminder. Some people wonder why, if you've listened to this as a podcast, we introduce a song and then you don't hear it. Well, as a podcast, we don't have the rights to all the songs we get, but if you want to hear the show in its entirety with all the music, Fridays at 12 o'clock. So I'm going to crack straight on. We've got a great show today. We've got a brilliant guest, someone that I share a lot of friends with, but yet we've never met before, so I'm looking forward to talking to him. His name is Tom Riley. He's currently in the BBC comedy Ill Behaviour, which Sam Bain of the Peep Show writers fame wrote. It's a great show, a dark comedy. I urge you to see that. I think it's on iPlayer and on BBC Two. But first of all, let's introduce back, it's finally a regular thing, Mr. James Gill, everybody, who is going to tell us all about how dark times have got for cinema. Hopefully there'll be some positivity in this. James, hello.
Dan, it's wonderful to see you. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you
for having me.
You
before we launch into this abyss.
Tell me, what's happened?
Well, so regular listeners will know that you and I have talked about this before, and last year we... I'm not saying that we plotted the death of cinema, but we certainly...
We definitely didn't plot it. I'm all in favour of trying to get it back.
We certainly licked our finger, popped it in the air to see which way the wind was blowing.
Yeah.
And it would appear... I don't want to sound smug, but we called it. We were correct in that numbers are dwindling.
Yeah.
And that unless you have, say, a Bond movie, a superhero movie, a movie that involves Vin Diesel and fast cars, you may well be struggling when it comes to the box office. And lo and behold, this summer, gross box office receipts are down 13% on last year, which I'm no Carol Vorderman, but that's a lot of money. And so what is possibly going to happen is that the window from cinema to home ends or video on demand, that window is potentially going to get smaller and smaller. So a lot of the studios are in favour of the window getting smaller and smaller. So a film comes out of the cinema, and then within a matter of weeks, you can watch it at home. You'll be paying more money, probably, you know, maybe £20, £30, £40, but that could well be the option. Nearly all the studios are in favour, apart from Disney. And if you look at the highest grossing movies of recent years, you will see why Disney are not in favour of it, because they are hoovering up.
That's also because they own several other studios, like they own Marvel and they own Pixar and they own, I don't know who else. There's like they ABC Television, they own.
Absolutely.
So they own probably a third of the entertainment business, right?
Absolutely. And on top of that, they're remaking their own movies. They're remaking, again, something that we talked about in the past. They're just raiding their back catalogue because they print money. The highest grossing movie worldwide so far this year, by some distance, is Beauty and the Beast.
Really?
It is, yeah.
Oh, that's surprising. What's the theory for having the window between cinema release and home video on demand or whatever being short? I would have thought if people thought, oh, I can't see that film for another 6 months, you might be more inclined to go and see it at the cinema. But there must... I'm obviously just a guy.
There's
lots of experts there that have got theories. So I'm not saying I'm right and they're all wrong, but...
How often do you hear this from friends these days? It's something that you didn't used to hear. What was the film like? Wait for it to come out on DVD. Or... wait for it to come out on Google Play. There's so many movies now that if it doesn't have the epic cinematography, if it doesn't have the explosions, if it doesn't have that, let's be honest, that huge big screen feel, you're probably going to wait for it to come on DVD or the digital equivalent. And that's the problem. There is a knight in shining armour, and his name is Christopher Nolan, and as long as he's around, he will be doing everything in his power to ensure that you still go to the cinema. But I mean, it's almost like one guy fighting the tide.
Yeah, well, he's very, very passionate about cinema, theatres, film, you know, celluloid. He's very old school, and...
generally speaking, I would compare the cinemas and the movie studios a little bit to black cabs and also Uber. Print media, in so much as that people were warning them of the dangers for years and they were too resistant to change. And now here we are having this conversation with... video on demand looming.
But the thing is it didn't get destroyed overnight like the music business did. You know, people have had a long time. They've had so long. Yeah, they've had so long to work this out.
In a nutshell, too many movies aren't quite good enough. If you and your missus want to go to the... Sorry for saying missus, it's just how I speak. If you and your missus want to go to the cinema and you get nachos, popcorn and a drink, you're not getting any change out of 40 quid. If you whack a babysitter on top of that, you might be talking the best part of £100. And if a film's not...
I get it,
film isn't absolutely sensational, you're not going to do it.
Yeah.
I can't say what film it was because I'm embargoed, but I saw a film the other night that is very hotly tipped and it's just not quite good enough to justify people spending all that money to go to the cinema. And instead, they will wait for that film to come onto Sky Store or Netflix or what have you.
I've probably said this before, but I just worry that what's happening, and as much as I love Netflix and Amazon Prime and all these things, I love having all that stuff at my fingertips, but I feel like films are going the way of music, which is that it becomes this disposable art form where you go, I've watched 10 minutes. I'll try something else.
So true, 100%.
I'm not into this. You don't give something the chance it should have. Sure, it does make the memory of driving all the way to a video shop, hiring something, a film for $3.99, taking it home, watching it and not being into it. It does seem like, really, we put up with that. But at the same time, you also watch things to the end. You kind of maybe enjoyed things a bit more because you're not doing so much comparison.
By the way, worth, I agree 100%. Nothing beats the feeling of going to the cinema. And when you're at the cinema, Brett Goldstein, our friend, will back me up on this, I have to sit on the front row because I feel like I'm in the movie. You don't get that watching a film on your phone on a train.
Even like indie films that don't have special effects, I'm like, I like the communal experience. Not too busy. I don't like sold out cinema.
I might disagree a little bit. Too often in recent weeks and months, and I love the cinema, and I've gone pretty much since birth. My grandparents took me every single week. I say that with no exaggeration. I've seen some terrible movies at the cinema. But too often recently, I've seen something on the big screen, and I've thought, that could have waited. And it breaks my heart to say that.
Well, look, the good news, the silver lining... Well, I don't know if it's a silver lining, but maybe it's just a freak accident. But
I would say the good news is that film studios, I think, really have to pull their socks up.
Well, yeah.
And I think they know that movies have to be really, really good.
But this summer, well, there's hope, you'd like to think. But this summer, there were three films, varying degrees of success financially,
yes,
that were successful, and they are Dunkirk, Baby Driver and The Big Sick. Now, obviously, The Big Sick, tiny compared to Dunkirk, but they were all films that made a profit, that people went into the cinema to see, and I guess, unless you say that Dunkirk is pre-existing IP because we've all heard of Dunkirk, they're all original films, original screenplays. I use screenplay in the loosest term with Dunkirk, just because there's little dialogue.
I agree.
They're original ideas that people actually went to see. You know, regardless of what you or I or anyone thinks of those three films, people went to see them and liked them. And first of all, I thought that hasn't happened in the summer blockbuster season in a long time. But then I thought, oh, maybe that's because all the other ones were so bad.
There've been some pretty dire blockbusters in not just this year, but
let's stay positive, James.
But I was going to say, The Big Sick almost reminded me in a way of the Blair Witch Project. Now, before you spit your coffee out at that comment, the Blair Witch Project was so cleverly marketed and it felt that everyone was talking about it, and it was a film that you felt you had to go see on the big screen. And The Big Sick had such a beautiful, positive word of mouth. It was a real word of mouth hit. And the way it was marketed, all right, they did it over Twitter, whereas Blair Witch was friends chatting in the street, didn't feel like they'd spent tens or hundreds of millions on the advertising. It was the quality of the product. And you felt, as with Blair Witch all those years ago, you felt that if you didn't see that film on the big screen, you were missing out on something.
Yeah.
But again, that comes back to our point. The Big Sick did well because it's a really good movie and people loved it and cared about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Dunkirk, if you didn't see that on the big screen, done yourself a disservice.
So you're a big thumbs up for Dunkirk, aren't you?
I mean, if Christopher Nolan asked me to be an extra in one of his movies, I'd be his butler for free for life. I love that man. I think Interstellar is one of my favourite.
20 years into being a butler for free,
I would do it. No, you know what? It was totally worth it. Mr. Nolan, if you're listening, it would totally be worth it. I thought Interstellar was a near perfect movie. I mean, these are movies that are profound. These are films that have something to say. These are films that stay with you long after the credits have rolled. And that's what Christopher Nolan delivers. You're not listening to this, Christopher, but if you are, I love you and everything that you've done for movies. For people like Dan and I who love cinema and we care so passionately about our films, I just wish there were 1,000 more of Christopher Nolan's out there.
I 100% agree with you. He's got like one or two films that I wasn't as into, but
across. Go on, which ones?
I wasn't a big fan of Inception. I'm not a massive fan of the first and third Batman movies. But.
Sorry, you can't see me wiping a tear from my right eye.
But I adored Interstellar. I adored the middle Batman film. I adore The Prestige. I adore Memento. So his films are either like I absolutely love or they leave me a bit cold. But they are mostly, there are more on the I absolutely love.
Interstellar, I would give the full 10 out of 10.
I think
10.
It's a beautiful, amazing movie. And Dunkirk I really love, by the way. I thought it was a tremendous film. I had one issue with it. It was Harry Styles. And it's not because he was perfectly good in it. He was actually really good in it, right? But it was that he, every time he appeared, I was like, Harry Styles, Harry Styles, One Direction, Harry Styles.
Mr. Nolan, with your permission, we think we could get some extra teenage bums on seats.
100%.
I thought he was absolutely fine.
Christopher Nolan turns to, what studio do his films?
Warners.
He goes to Warners and he says, my next film, it's about Dunkirk.
Yes.
And there's not going to be much talking in it. And they're like, okay, we'll greenlight this, but you have to put either Justin Bieber or one of One Direction in it. Because there is no way anyone's going to see this film. I do believe that, because he's got something like 50 million Twitter followers. If just an eighth of those people But anyway, I don't want to think that it was that calculated.
But the fact that he's making such an experimental movie...
Yeah,
is wonderful. It's such a special thing in the year 2017.
But this is the thing. I just want to go back to the Harry Styles thing, because it isn't like that he's acting, although that annoys me a bit. It's more that if you're doing a period film and then you put someone that is so connected to popular culture, that's a gimmick in there. Like, I felt like the authenticity of the costumes and the look of it and the feel of it. Tom Hardy, his face was covered for most of it, so I'm not going, oh, that's Tom Hardy. And anyway, I'm used to seeing him in films. Kenneth Branagh, he looks like he's from that era.
Yes.
You know, so does Mark Rylance.
Yes, yeah.
Kenneth Branagh speaks like he's from the
40s.
You know, I get that, but you pop a singer from One Direction, I'm just like, oh, that's him. I'm happy to see him in an indie contemporary film or even a blockbuster or whatever, but just I think it, putting him in a period set film just slightly, it just marred it ever so slightly for me. Apart from that, I thought it was beautiful. James, come back again, please. Now, before we talk to today's guest, the lovely Tom Riley, we are going to play his first of two choices of songs or music from films. This is from the film Magnolia, and it is the excellent Amy Mann with Wise Up.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Begin it.
have it. Thanks, Tom, for bringing the vibe down.
Just thought we'd start really, really low.
Really low, yeah. A bit depressed. No, I actually love that song, and I have to admit, when I first saw Magnolia, which that is from, I think I even cried a little bit in that bit. Or at least a tear.
Yeah, just a single tear. I think that was the plan.
Is that... are you a fan of the film?
I loved the film, yeah. I love the film. And
it's kind of amazing, isn't it?
It is. It's incredible.
It's hard to watch because it's such a onslaught of drama and...
And occasional weird out there comedy. Like, my reason for picking that is a really... It's kind of... I mean, starting melancholy and then just segueing straight into pretentious.
Okay, good. That's two of my favourite things.
Like, I'm looking to direct a little short at the beginning of next year, and I've been trying to work out a way to do it, this kind of weird version where you are aware that the film that you're watching is like a film, but you still connect to it. And I felt like with Magnolia, with that scene in particular, you're clearly, it's like the audience is complicit in going, oh, I'm just watching all the actors sing together, and yet somehow I'm moved, and this shouldn't work, but it does.
Yeah, well, that's the main thing. It shouldn't work, and it does. Yeah. When I first saw it, I was almost annoyed.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Tom Cruise singing along to Amy Mann, and then a dying man in bed singing along to Amy Mann.
Whereas at least you had the response of like, fuck, that's cool, and I loved it. Whereas I, like, my best friend, I was like, you've got to see this movie. It's incredible. It just flips all the conventions on its head. And he watched it and was like, that was just fucking stupid. I hated it. What was that about? I didn't buy it at all.
Did you defriend him?
We haven't talked in 10 years.
That's because he's not on social media and you can't get hold of him.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. And I love the frogs as well. That was like, what the... Yeah. What is going on? This is... You know, and also it's so sincere as well.
Yeah.
So he's managed to do it without being too arch.
It's also one of the last times that I think John C. Reilly was playing that sort of part, but for serious reasons. Ever since then, he's played that part, but it's been... comic.
Yeah, yeah. Do you so you want to direct?
I mean,
like, sell it hard. Come
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, there's something that I've been trying
Don't
to get
off
the ground.
Don't go into a pitch with that sort
years.
Of attitude.
And it's a friend wrote it, we're going to make it, it's going to happen, but yeah, it's interesting because it's starting at the beginning of a different version of this career, and when you're doing okay on the other side, it's hard to go, oh, I'll give that job up for 3 months while I just like try for something that might not
come
off.
I know all about that. Mm-hmm. I spin way too many plates
too
and
many
sometimes
plates.
I think, oh shit, if I just focused on one thing, I'd be much further in my career.
Yeah.
You and I have a bizarrely large amount of people in common, and yet we have never met. This is the first time we met. It
Who
feels
do you
like
begin with?
You want?
Who do you want to begin with?
Well, I was going to say, this feels like when people set you up on a date and go, you two would really get on well. And it's like, I feel like it's going pretty good.
Yeah.
I definitely find you attractive.
Thank you so much. You live up to every single word of your profile.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I have, you know, obviously lit all my pictures really well on my Tinder profile. I would probably start with Drew because we could go in sort of order of people that I think you... met that I know. Does that make sense?
Yes.
What
I've
just
said.
Start
with Drew.
So Drew, that must be like almost 10 years ago that you worked with him. So he's
2008. Yeah,
he's a very talented writer, director, doing his first feature in the US,
just wrapped
with Jodie Foster, which is very exciting. So you worked with him on the American version of No Heroics.
No Heroics.
Yeah,
which was. I mean, I don't know how many stories I can tell about that because obviously, like,
tell some.
You go
tell.
Hiking with Drew, and he just gives up everything.
Yeah,
about,
yeah.
But like, it was the ITV2 sitcom No Heroics, which is about superheroes and their psychics, and they were kind of terrible, terrible superheroes,
and really, kind of about them when they're not at work.
Yeah, when they're not at work, and if they were at work, their superpowers are just crap.
Yeah.
Like, I played a gay SAS British guy whose superpower was, I think, like reading people's minds, but only if they were within 5 meters or something. Just something like everything with a disclaimer. And we did it for, and it was such a dark script. And I remember when I was sent it, them saying, like, this is on ABC, like, this can't possibly go to series. And so we got there on set, and we were like, we were having to change jokes on the fly, like on the floor. Suddenly someone at Disney going, like, you can't finish with a Princess Diana car crash joke, that has to go.
Oh my God.
And you'd be like, but you've had this script for
how did it get through?
So we did, we changed it all on and actually I really liked it. It's really good. I met Drew on it and made some really good friends, and it never went to series.
Was that the first time you worked in the US?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, that must have been exciting.
Yeah, it was great.
Isn't it amazing?
Craft service. Like, yeah. That's all it's about, is you're like, and this is all, I can just take these
I can
like,
all day
all long.
Day for yeah. free. And really good quality.
Yeah.
I don't understand why on British TV shows, even high budget, you know, like big dramas, which you've been on plenty of, that in England, it's still like food from the 1970s.
Yeah.
You know, and white bread with just yeah. a bit of ham in the middle, or...
Well, the job that I'm sure we'll talk about that I just did had literally... Their craft service table was a sink, like an old rusty sink, and on it there was a paint can, empty paint can full of biscuits, and another empty paint can of tea bags, and just, like, milk.
And no paint!
No paint!
Bloody hell!
So I couldn't even scrawl my yeah. objections all over it. Yeah.
That is amazing, and all the strange school dinners, puddings that they still do, the spotted dick and...
Semolina.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing, because I would say that the entertainment industry is one industry where there are a lot of people who are probably more health conscious than a lot, you know, than maybe some other industries, and yet it's still this weird... Oh, yeah, it's bizarre. So we have Drew in common. We also have, bizarrely, this was bizarre for me, I had my second cousin in. Who directed you in the film? you look shocked because you're like, "What is this?
Who's this going to?" Oh, it's Bill,
Stop,
isn't it?
Bill Clark. Yeah.
Who I didn't know you were related.
Neither did I.
How weird.
I found out like a week or two before that film came out. My mum sent me an email. She lives out in Spain and went, "Your cousin's film's out this week," and I'm like, "Who?" Because none of my cousins are in the film business.
Yeah.
Now, in fact, I've never had anyone in all my life in the business that I could, like, ask for favours or advice.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's
Turns
this person.
Out this guy has been there for years. Yeah.
And I was like, "What the fuck do you mean?"
Yeah.
And she sent me a link to it. I said, "Why has no one ever told me this before?" And it turns out that his side of the family, we kind of drifted apart a bit. So I
was
got in touch.
Was this like serious drama?
Yeah. No, there wasn't. Well, not that, unless people have not told me about some heinous thing that happened. But yeah, so I got him in and I went to see the film. And I mean, I wanted to talk to you about that because that was... I was really impressed by that. I mean, that must have been a tiny budget, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you talk about craft services, but we were like, dressing rooms were on the floor of like a kitchen in a military base, and we were just, everything was on the fly.
Starfish, for people that haven't heard the episode where I interviewed Bill, this is a drama that is about a guy suffering from, sepsis. Yeah. And you're in makeup for like 90% of that film, and I have to say, for a film of such tiny budget, it is an incredible makeup.
Well, that was the one thing, Joe Froggatt, who also produced it, and me were both like, this bit has to work. Like, even if we put money anywhere, it has to be on that, because if that doesn't hold up, the whole thing's going to fall to pieces.
Yeah. You would just tune off straight away,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was just a bad prosthetic.
And do I remember right that you said he even used the original guy's like hands and limbs and things for certain shots?
For like close-ups, actually, on Tom, the other Tom's, you know, his real spinning limbs and stuff, and I just had sort of specially made gloves.
You know, this is where I'm not like an actor in that sense. I'm sort of always thought of myself as sort of winging it a bit. Is I look at that and I think, God, that looked like hard work.
Yeah, but like it's so
is it rewarding.
It's rewarding, but it's also so difficult for me to make any like, oh, that's prosthetics for 6 weeks. Yeah. And, I just had to eat my food with a straw because like the real Tom, that's his life for the last 15, 20 years. And he's got this incredible optimism with it, and he's positive and accepting. And so to me, go like, oh, the prosthetics. I had to get up so early. So like,
to him, nudging him, going, God, this is tough.
Trust me, I'll do that bitching about other jobs, but this one I have to be like, no.
Of course.
You know, it's
of course.
Like,
but also, I just thought like emotionally, like you must have really got into that, like that sort of zone of feeling like, you know, how limited you are every day. I was thinking, what was the mood like on that shoot?
Well, I learned a long time ago that it just didn't help me to like be miserable in order to play miserable, or to like be angry. Yeah. If I'm going to be a very unpleasant, broken person, I can't take it home at the end of the night, because then I like ruin both my work day and my home life.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have long ago, like, I try to be as stupid as possible when the prosthetics come off, or even during takes. It's like, because the mood, you are responsible for it if you're at the top of the call sheet.
Of course.
And like, I just would never let, I try not to let it. I mean, maybe on days where they're deeply, deeply emotional, but generally I try and shrug it off.
And did everyone else on the crew sort of appreciate that? Were they into the same spirit of it? Because I've never really done a drama, and I've heard some people say who've done comedy and then they go and do a drama and they're like, why is everyone so serious? Why is it so quiet? And that, I think that's kind of more what I meant with when I said it just looked hard. Like, is that just like turning up to this environment that feels so, you know?
Yeah, it
but you,
it
you're obviously dicking about.
I try to dick, but like the other problem with dicking about is that there are still those actors out there who do want to do that very deep thinking. Yeah. I'm being, this is my moment, and so I need to rein that instinct to be like, I'm gonna be off my chops in between scenes in, because some people are like, no, I'm
how do you gauge whether you're acting opposite someone that wants to do their process more seriously?
Whether they look at me like I'm a piece of shit when I do it the first time, I'm like, that okay, cool, okay, good to know.
We now
good
know the yeah. Oh, that's a good way of doing it. I guess there's a bit of risk. Did you do any research into, and like how much time did you spend like learning about what I mean, like, was there a, you know, physical, you know, like you hear about people have to go and learn how to walk with.
Yeah, well, I spent a bit of time with Tom, and actually you can see it in the film a bit, which I don't think I've ever said this before, but like the beginning of the movie, I'm faking having fake legs. So mm-hmm. I'm sort of, there weren't braces on or anything. I'm literally just doing it all walking. And I assumed it would be very stiff walking like that. So the beginning of the movie, you can see I'm doing this kind of like wooden boy walk. Mm-hmm. And then the more I watched Tom, the more I realized that he had this kind of roll, which I guess was how his hips had adapted to the way he walks. So my walk actually changes throughout the whole movie from the beginning to the end, because I'm just trying to like, well, oh, that's how he does it. Okay. And I was changing it slightly. Because neither of us got to spend as much time with Tom or his wife Nick as we wanted to, because the film was in development, Bill must have told you, for years. Yeah, yeah. And like,
because he was a friend of his, or he knew the
yeah,
guy.
They,
yeah,
he knows that. Yeah. He worked with Nick on the company together. They were both in production together somewhere. But so we didn't want to meet Tom and Nick until we knew it was like signed and happening. When we both said we'd do it a year before, but then there were like budget issues, it dropped out. It came and went. So we didn't want to meet them until, but literally it was one of those independent movie things where they went, we've got the money. Are you free next week? We'll shoot it in 4 weeks. And both Joe and I were like, okay. So we only met them at the last minute. I didn't have enough time to really get to know.
Frightening that. I remember a producer friend of mine telling me that he didn't get the money of the film until the day of wrap.
I believe
so it. So they're like, he was just borrowing money for a week and then borrowing it again and paying off that debt so that he only had a debt for a week. Because he was, you know, promised this money. So he just had to keep it coming. I'm like, how do you not die of stress?
Yeah.
I have
just
no idea.
Lying to people's faces every day. Yeah. Oh my God.
So you've gone from, I mean, that was out end of last year, mm-hmm. right? And this year you're playing someone with cancer.
It's just as easy as
what
I'm just
is
like
going
the
on.
Yeah, do if you, I could do huge physical transformations, I'll
yeah.
do it.
Are you just, you're like, your agent calls, hey, we got this great part. Is he dying?
Yeah.
No, not interested.
Not interested. Do I have to lose all my hair, go on a crash juice diet for 4 weeks in Bristol? I'm in.
Yeah. What drew you to this?
Sam. Bang.
Yeah.
It was very much a case, the scripts were great. And I think, it was originally offered to my girlfriend, who's also in it with me.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally offered to her a few days before. She was like, I've been offered this thing in England. And I read it. I was like, those guys, like Sam Bain and Ian Morris, take it seriously. Don't just go like, oh, it's something on the BBC.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she read it and was like, this is really good. And then I got a call 2 days later about it, completely random.
Total coincidence.
I mean, potentially, there's a little bit of me in the back of my head, so like, I wonder if I was a bargaining chip to get her.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like a little part of me that has always like gone, like, yeah, okay. But it was just a great script and so daring and risky.
Yeah.
And like, there's so many chances for it to like fall flat on its face.
So this is called Ill Behaviour and it's on BBC Two at the moment, but also you can watch the whole thing on BBC Three.
No. Nope. Just an iPlayer.
Online. iPlayer.
Yeah, it's not a BBC Three thing. I don't know why.
Well, it's just online.
It's just online.
I think for some reason I've just got this BBC Three. I love that you really were. You pretty, you know,
it's because
vigilant about
it's because
correcting
I've
me
seen that people say it on Twitter and other people get very angry at them.
They?
So I'm taking on that
role.
You're
taking a lot of anger, aren't you? You're like, I didn't almost die for nothing. I don't know if you do or don't die in the end. So
keep watching.
That's not a spoiler, guys. So can you sort of do a little bit of a like, you know, the summary of what the story is of this Can you? Because I've seen the first episode, which I love, by the way, and there's kind of stuff in it that if I was a viewer, I'd kind of like to not have known that. That would have been fun. But are you okay. sort of just pretty much telling everyone the premise?
Well, which bits don't you want to know?
well, we are recording, so that's you put me in a bit of a tricky situation here.
Give me just hints.
Towards the end, when they make a decision to do something for your character.
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah,
that
I
bit.
Feel like we're just telling people that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, go ahead and tell them. you have zero respect for your audience.
What, I'll do a version of it and tell me if I need to add more.
Okay, go.
We'll just softly.
Yeah, I like
so
it.
It's about... a bunch of friends.
You need to do more than that. That's just
one of them is a homeopathy obsessed new age guy called mm-hmm. Charlie, played by me, mm-hmm. and he gets cancer, Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is 94% curable with chemotherapy, but he won't do chemotherapy. He wants to heal with juices and like enemas, etc. Mm-hmm. And then he's got two best friends. One, Joel, played by Chris Gere, is brilliant, who has just got divorced. And
you meet the character.
Yeah.
You're not just giving us
Chris has just got
additional
divorced.
Info
he was
about
very,
his personal.
Very unhappy, so decided to do this job as a waiter. No, his character's just got divorced and has come into a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And then his other friend, Tess, who is a science fiction writer. And those two people decide that if Charlie isn't going to take the chemotherapy himself, they will take matters into their own hands with the help of an alcoholic oncologist doctor, played by Lizzie Kaplan.
Who is also...
her indoors, yeah.
Your... well, not so indoors. She seems to work quite
yeah,
a lot.
She's out a lot, actually. Yeah, I'm mainly indoors. Yeah.
Him indoors.
Yeah.
So it's a great cast and such a brilliant premise. Again, one of those premises where I'm a bit like, oh, damn.
Yeah.
I wish I'd thought of that. But
also like a hard sell as a premise. Like, it's one of those things that when you hear it, the fact it's got made, you go, that sounds great. Mm. But I think if you're in the room as a commissioner and someone's going, so this guy gets cancer, and then, you know, I think it's up people go, oh, no, I'm
yeah.
out. And it's a comedy, no.
Yeah.
You
know? From what I know, because I know Sam a little bit, I think it did take him a very long time
yeah,
to get it made.
5 years, yeah. I think. It was originally a movie, and then Ian suggested they break into a... TV
yeah, right.
series.
I mean, what great credentials you got. One of the writers from Peep Show and a producer from In Between Us. I mean, you must have just been, yep, I'll do it.
Yep,
I haven't read it, I'll do it.
No, I mean, I read it, but initially I was like, I will read it because it's them.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
no way this will be bad. And also, like, because it's funny, when you get to that point in your career like Sam and Ian have, like, even things in a script that might make you go, I don't know. If you know that they're behind you, like, oh, I'll stick with this.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if it had come from a fresh writer, I might have been less likely to take a gamble on it.
Right. So even at, like, 2 pages towards the end, I'll stick with it. Something could happen.
Stick with it. Like, maybe in the next series.
Yeah. It feels like a bit of an anti-homeopathy show, in a way. Bit of a slight on people that believe in... alternative therapies, would you say? It doesn't come off well, is all I'm saying.
It doesn't come off well.
Where do you stand on that? Because I'm actually quite into a bit of alternative, or let's say, Eastern medicine.
I would say, as someone says in the show, as a side order to the main dish of chemotherapy, absolutely.
Yeah,
do everything you can to keep your body, you know, as fighting fit as it can be. But some things can't be beaten
by what? I thought you were being terribly racist there. I what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, I thought that there was a little bit of the Steve Jobs story. Do you know about this?
Which one? Which part?
Because he was so, arrogant is probably the best use of word. He had so much self-belief that when he got cancer, he genuinely believed, because everything he'd ever wanted and thought of had come true in his life, that he could beat this without traditional medicine, or, you know, not traditional, actually, Western medicine. And he did everything except for, like, chemotherapy or whatever, and he didn't beat it. And in the very last stages, he ended up, he decided, look, I better do chemotherapy, but by that point it was too late.
Is that true?
Well, according to the documentary about Steve Jobs I watched, that's what they said.
God,
but,
okay.
you know,
yeah.
someone better fact check that just in case it's wrong. But I do think there is, I think that's what you just said, you know, that little thing of, like, keep yourself healthy, but also, you know, blitz the fucker.
Just listen to the doctors. Because we also met a bunch of people in the NHS, and it's surprising how many of these oncologists said to us, this isn't unusual, this happens a lot, that people come in and say, no, I don't want chemotherapy, I don't believe in that type of medicine, I want natural medicine. And doctors sit there and go, okay, we have to respect your wishes, but knowing that this, we have the facts, we have the statistics, this isn't what's best for you. Yeah. There's nothing we can do.
I would argue that there's probably more. We've gone into a sort of weird medical element of the show. but I would argue that it was probably more to do with what, you know, in terms of health and, you know, what you put in your body and clean living and all that is more to do with preventing getting it in the first place than fixing it after the fact.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Just keeping the engine tuned up and
come
nice.
On, you live in LA a lot. You know, it's all about the juices and the kale.
Yeah,
and
but
the,
also that shit changes on a weekly basis.
Yeah. You never know what's suddenly like, what? You mean kale gives you diabetes? Yeah.
And he passed the thing. What was the thing? The other day, a sweat lodge.
Yeah.
Where you go in and you get wrapped in an infrared sleeping bag and watch Netflix for an hour while you sweat.
I love the sound of that.
I mean, it's like, and apparently you burn 800 calories. So everyone's like, I'm in. But I don't go to the gym and I just like get in a sleeping bag and watch This Is Us for an hour. Like, it's perfect.
What kind of sleeping bag and have they washed it? That's all
if they smell
know.
Clean. I mean, what I'm saying
you've
is I've done it.
Yeah. you see, you weren't going to admit to it. And, So that's on at the moment, not on BBC Three. Did you? I mean, after that and after Starfish, are you just like, please, can I just have healthy, upbeat? I mean, he is actually quite upbeat character.
Yeah, it's
but,
pretty cheery compared to the rest.
You're
of
like,
them.
Let's just know. I just want all singing, all dancing characters for the next couple of years. Or are you like, what's next? I want to be someone who is actually already dead.
I mean, how
far can you go?
I'm my own worst enemy because I finish a job like that and I'm like, the next job, just a guy who sits down. That would be nice in the sunshine. And then after about 3 months, I just get bored and I'm like, I have to do something that like makes me feel like I've.
Have you ever made
different.
That mistake in a scene when you're about to film and you're blocking it with the director and you're so tired because, you know, the hours are long and you're like, I just haven't got the energy today. I know, I'll say that my character should be sitting in this.
Yeah.
And they go, okay, fine. So you're sitting in that scene. But then what happens is because you're sat there for so long, you're just falling asleep.
Yeah.
You've just got no energy.
Yeah. Or you play the entire scene, which could be quite a high octane scene, just like this. Yeah, terrible news about that. You won the lottery. Great.
In between words, your belly rumbles because you're so hungry.
Exactly. Happens all the time.
So the other person, of course, that we... Mm-hmm. Well, there must be more than this, but the person I'm thinking of is
Laura, right?
Laura Haddock.
Yeah.
Who obviously I was in a show with for many years. And you did... you were in Da Vinci's Demons for three series,
4 years. Yeah.
That's pretty good going. And was that a big show? I mean that in the most in not an unflattering way, because there are so many shows out there now, you don't know whether something how big a show can be sometimes.
I think that's the fairest way to describe it.
Really?
It's like someone to say, is that a big show? Because to all intents and purposes, yes, in that the budget was huge.
Yeah.
It was gigantic around the world. And we would go to Portugal and we'd go to Brazil and we'd have people like screaming our names and then we'd come back here and people go, is that a big show? and I get it. Like it was when we were on set, it's funny you talk about the craft service, it felt like an American show. Everything was, it was for an American network and it had very, the credentials of the people behind it was very solid and we really thought we were going to make something huge. Mm. And then as the years went on, the budget got bigger, which it does in American TV rather than here when you have a success and they go, can you do it again but cheaper?
Yeah.
And yet it was like just not, there's no publicity over here, nothing. So it was a really sort of strange beast to be involved in.
I always, it's sort of the Bush effect, and I mean the band, not the either the president or the hedge or whatever else. It's, I always remember that Bush, the band, was slightly annoyed that they were absolutely ginormous in America, but no one really gave a shit in the UK.
Yeah.
There's still that thing, because like America, if you crack America,
you're
sorted.
Yeah.
But yet you kind of want to crack your home town or country, don't you? You sort of like, when you make something, you want everyone where you grew up to see it, don't you?
So yeah, like, I can't really put the blame at anyone. It's not the publicist's fault. It's not anyone's fault. It's just people. Game of Thrones was happening at the same time.
Right.
We happened to be on Fox here, which wasn't as watched as most other networks. So it was just, like, unfortunate.
Really. Was it critically well received?
It was mixed. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like, there were some people who loved it, especially that first series, and then... You know, it was an interesting one.
Yeah.
I loved it. I've made some of my best friends on it. I'm really proud of it.
And you shot that up in Wales, right?
Swansea. Yeah.
Swansea.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it weird that these shows like that get made in Swansea? There's so many things. Like, so you've done a Doctor Who, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've done a Doctor Who. Is that something you get sort of asked about or sort of people come up to you more than other things you've done?
I mean, I was long blonde hair, blonde beard, and it looked very different.
Are you sure you were in it?
Yeah.
Listen, we will find out the truth. You can't just blag this sort
of
thing nowadays.
I mean, I was basically me playing Carrie Elwes playing Errol Flynn as Robin Hood. Certainly more male. Like, that's what happened. You get a lot more letters, a lot more sort of...
Oh, I thought you meant just all
more
men.
Male attention. Yeah. I'm very much subject to the male gaze.
Yeah, well, this blonde hair and blonde beard does sound very fetching.
Yeah.
Actual letters? Do people still do that?
Yeah, people still send it. But I think letters and photos and that stuff really, that doubles when you do a Doctor Who. Triples, quadruples, more than I've ever had. It was nuts.
Yeah. We had Ingrid Oliver in before. We were
lovely
trying to work
Ingrid.
Out what the kind of verb for... what was it we were trying to... She's... Speak to me. Hoovian, we were saying.
Oh,
is there
Hoovian.
A word, like, for being... I can't even remember the context.
Yeah, there's a word for being a fan.
Yeah.
And Ingrid's been in, like, more than one
She's
episode.
Been in a
She's
lot,
She's been
yeah.
in loads. Like.
And you also did a brilliant episode of Inside Number 9, so you've got your cult quota sorted as well, haven't you?
That is something I can say without... That's great, that episode of TV. That I think we knew when I read it initially, I just finished filming, literally finished 10 minutes before the final season or the second season of Da Vinci. And I was in the car going back to London and I got the offer, do you want to do this episode of Inside Number? I didn't read it. I was like, I love that show, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then when I got home and read it, I was like, and this is one of the greatest things. Goosebumps from reading it.
Was it with Sheridan?
Sheridan,
yeah. Yeah, that was pretty amazing. I mean... What I just love how much they're pushing. I mean, I don't know what you call it because it's something other than comedy or drama but like just so out there. And the fact that they keep coming up with these ideas.
I don't know how they do it.
No.
It's amazing.
Again, another thing where I'm like, fuck. Because I'm a very generous spirited person, you know.
Yeah.
I see things and I'm very loving about it.
But inside, just a little bit of hate.
Always. That's a part of me dies. Now, actually, I've been pretty good. I started meditation, by the way, Tom.
How's it been?
It's literally early days.
Right.
But I already feel different.
Are you doing it with an app or with a human?
I'm sort of doing it on my own, actually. But I've taken classes. I've actually paid to take classes.
Okay.
Because I felt like I'll be accountable. There'll be an investment. I'll be like, this fucker's charged me loads of money just to do something I could have done for free on the internet.
Yeah.
But I really feel like it's the thing that got me into it. Otherwise, I would have just kept putting it off. It's good. Do you do any?
I do. Yeah, I tried a little bit of mindfulness.
Yeah?
Which I think is... I mean, I was speaking to Sam Bain about this. He was like, basically, someone has, with mindfulness, has monetized Buddhism, which is like basically against what Buddhism is.
Yeah.
But it's that idea of just like going, okay, I'm here. Because, you know, we live in this world, and I'm sure you're the same with Twitter and Instagram, where you constantly need a hit of like dopamine
something,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, what's happening now? What's going on in the news? It's constant. There's always somewhere else to be, no matter where you are. So, like, being able to go, I'm just going to be with me for a bit. Nice.
Absolutely agree. What I find weird about this hit of dopamine thing is it's not. We're not always after something that's actually good.
No.
Like, you understand why someone's addicted to alcohol or drugs because... the initial hit is good, but often when I'm searching for something online, it's because what I read will annoy me or upset me. So it's like, where's the fun in any of this? And yet I'm addicted to it.
It's like searching for reviews of your own stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you're either going to get a spike of, I'm great, or like, everyone hates me. And like, yet still you do it just for that feeling of like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, next time we meet, which, you know, who knows when that will be, I'll be in robes. I'll have a completely bald head.
Shave it.
Yeah, yep. Definitely. Shave the head.
Yeah.
You're in a relationship with an actress, a very, I think it's fair to say, a very successful actress. How do you find that, being two people in a relationship? Because I'm in a relationship with someone who's an actress and a writer and in the arts, and God, it gets tough sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what we have done, and we both came into it with very open eyes, which is that feeling of like, okay, we've both been in relationships before that have been affected by the industry. What are the things we need to do and what do we not need to do? Let's be careful in this stuff. Let's be careful, like, when we take jobs, how far away are they? How far do you have to be apart from each other?
Because, and was there a lawyer there to deal with all the
we had a third party just to
witness it all.
But no, it was all just like, it was just a very kind of adult, grown up mid-30s conversation about, like, okay, how can we make this work in a way that, like...
And do you point to the rules whenever you sort of find yourselves arguing about something?
I believe you said this.
Do you remember at the beginning?
It's been great. Well, also, we've been very lucky thus far in that neither of us have had a job at the same time that's so great that we have to go, like, I'm going to be in Alaska, you're going to be in New Zealand, but we've both got to do this.
Yeah.
But it's always been a case of, like, oh, that job's great for you, and I don't have anything right now that's as exciting for me, so I can come with you or be around, you know.
I actually saw your wedding invitation to Drew on the wall of his kitchen.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I was like, when am I ever going to meet this guy?
I don't even believe
he exists.
Drew's not even coming, but he keeps it up. What is he thinking?
Isn't he?
Yeah, I get what Drew's doing. Can't make it, but I'll keep that on the wall.
Just in case he pops around.
Yeah.
He'll think I still care.
Yeah.
I sort of hate this question, because whenever I'm interviewed about stuff, I always think, why does it have to be about what's next? But what is next?
I've had a really interesting year of, like, I've been very adamant that I didn't want to get caught up in a series again unless I loved it, like a long-term series.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you about this show that I haven't seen, and I love the look of it. I certainly love the cast, and there's the collection on Amazon.
Yeah.
Now, what was that show?
That was on Amazon, as you say. It was by the guy who directed and created Pretty Little Lies and Desperate Housewives and stuff. It's about fashion in the 50s, 40s, just post Second World War in Paris. Richard Coyle and like Michelle Gomez and this and Mamie Gump, incredible cast.
Yeah.
I don't think we're doing it again. I think it's done.
Yeah. When did you do it?
We did it last, I think, beginning of last year. I'm not even sure now.
Where did you shoot? In Swansea.
Literally the same studio as I shot Da Vinci.
So how many things have you shot in
Wales?
Yeah.
So many.
Let's go through them.
Doctor Who.
Yeah.
All the seasons of Da Vinci's.
Yeah.
The collection. I think I did a movie a long time ago that was on location there. I'm Welsh.
You did that, shot that video for the Welsh Tourist Board.
I did, yeah. I am actually at the Cardiff Airport. Genuinely, when it says welcome to Wales, it's me dressed as Da Vinci's.
What? You're not really.
That's right, I really
am. Are you serious?
Like on a horseback going, welcome to Wales. It's.
I can't tell if you're joking.
I know. That's the thing about it. Like, I can't even tell if I'm joking, but it's true.
It is actually true.
It feels like a joke, but it's true.
Oh my God, I love this. Because they're that proud of you in particular, or the show, or the people filming?
I think people filming.
Yeah,
I don't think they're that proud of me. With my Irish surname being a Welshman, but I think, like, yeah, they are.
I love your name. I was thinking about this on the way here. I was thinking if you'd called yourself Thomas Riley, you would have sounded pretentious. Mm-hmm. No, you would have sounded like someone who had travelled to America in the 1600s or something. Or
yeah,
there's something very sort of
pioneer-like.
Yeah,
yeah.
I would guess it because it sounds like Walter Riley or something. But Thomas Riley, it just. Mm. I think you'd be getting a lot of Benedict Cumberbatch's work if you'd gone with Thomas.
That's my mistake.
Yeah. You don't sound...
I don't sound like I'm from Eton.
No.
No.
Where are you from? Where did you grow up?
Maidstone.
Yeah.
Do you know Maidstone?
I know Maidstone. Well, not very well, but my mum ran a pub in a place called Yalding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know Yalding.
For
like
15 years. So I grew up in the sort of very suburbs of southeast London and Kent.
Right. Okay.
And then they moved out when I was like 18 and got a pub in that part. So I know Kent.
Near Maidstone, the town of flowers.
Wow.
That's what they call it.
Yeah.
We had a giant sheep made of flowers.
The
town, Maidstone.
Right.
In the centre of the town square. And it was unveiled by Boyzone. And that was
Oh my god.
Yeah, that was the best thing that happened.
As a four piece or five?
Oh, I can't remember if Stephen was still there.
Yeah.
Maybe a four piece.
Okay, that's got a bit depressing. Okay. So
for some reason in my head I thought he left.
Oh no. Yeah. Okay, so this is the weirdest segue I've ever done, but your guilty pleasures. So we ask all our guests to...
Thanks for bringing this.
We ask all our guests to pick a guilty pleasure just to chat about. Obviously this represents something that you recognise as a bit naff, or mm-hmm. or maybe you think it's great and it's underrated. And I know that you've probably got wonderful taste usually, but you picked quite a lot of guilty pleasures, like about five or six. Like,
yeah, but some of them are more guilty than others. I think I was trying to.
You're Catholic, right? Because you seem to have a lot of guilt.
Shame, yeah. No, like some of them, I think I was probably trying to take the sting out of quite how guilty the other ones were.
Yeah. Well, I was quite surprised. So my producer, Natalie, was saying, well, which one are you going to go with? Because we have to pick one. But I can't not mention them all. So you went TV-wise.
Yeah.
This was the slightly surprising one. So you picked the Real Housewives of, is it? Of
wherever, of Beverly Hills.
You love
of
them all.
Orange County, of New York.
Okay.
Love is strong.
All right. But you... That we can understand why that's a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
Right. It's obvious. You should be deeply ashamed.
Absolutely.
But I get why it's probably highly entertaining. But you also picked Rick and Morty.
Not really a guilty pleasure. Just wanted to mention how much I liked it.
Oh, cunning. I like it. You knew what we would think. We'd think, why is he picking
that? That's weird. But we should mention that actually he does have taste as well to offset the...
Oh, I see. Okay. I wondered whether you thought... This is a terrible show, but I love it.
No, it's wonderful.
Okay, good. All right. And then, of course, film-wise, you picked the John Wick anthology.
Yeah. Do you think that counts as a guilty pleasure?
I don't know, because we live in an age where there's so much sort of irony for what we like, and in a way it kind of doesn't feel... It's definitely not Housewives guilt, is it? But it's also not, like, high art, is it?
No.
I mean, I'm ashamed to say this because I sort of present a show about film and television, but I've not seen either John Wick film. No, because I just, I don't know. Action, very rarely do action films like entertain me anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's why I like this one.
Yeah? What is it you like about it?
I just like the fact it's all about a man taking revenge for someone killing his dog. And as someone who owns a dog, I can completely understand. I would go on a killing spree.
Would you?
For buns.
Would you?
Yeah.
That's
the dog's name.
You don't mean you get payment in buns.
In buns, yeah.
I'll kill
in
for buns.
Cinnamon buns. What do you got?
Yeah. Stick them in my dressing room and I'm going to kill. Is it played like properly serious and earnestly, even though it's revenge for his dog?
No, I think there is. That's what makes it a slight guilty pleasure, is that they're winking at the camera ever so slightly, but not enough. Mm-hmm. It's earnest enough, while at the same time being like, this is a bit stupid.
And I hear the action in it is phenomenal.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Balletic.
I'm going to go and watch it tonight, I think.
You should, both.
That is, well, you know, I'll promise the first one. Let's see how I get on. And the other film you picked was, or the two films, see, this is how many you are riddled with guilt, aren't you?
One was more like a genre.
Yeah.
You know.
So The Planes, Trains, and Parenthood.
Parenthood, see, that kind of Steve Martin 80s, 90s comedy.
Yeah, see, I think here at Screen Talk Towers, which is something I've never said, and I'm already hating myself for that. That was a guilty pleasure saying that. I think that's not a guilty pleasure.
No, probably
partly
not.
Because I feel like comedy is in such a weird place in film, especially nowadays, that, you know, I just look back on that probably with rose-tinted glasses and think, oh, I wish they'd make something as good as Planes, Trains.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think I just wanted to say that too.
You were wrong. You fucked up with that one.
I just long for optimism in cinema again.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah,
that's why I like Wonder Woman.
Did you?
Yeah, the first two thirds. Yeah,
I could see you in that
as Gal Gadot's role.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
It's the shapely pins.
I think shave the beard, but get the old blonde hair back from the Robin Hood thing.
Yeah,
she's I don't know where I'm going with this.
I'm looking forward
to
it.
Shall I just carry on with this sentence to see where it goes?
Yeah, just test.
I've said she's, but I don't know the rest of the sentence. She's She's really good in that film.
She is.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
Yeah.
Very charming.
Have you seen anything this year that you particularly...
The Big Sick.
Yep. Enjoyed
I
that.
Which I loved.
Yeah. I think I was affected by the hype a little bit, yeah. But I still really enjoyed it. I think if I knew nothing about it, I would have gone, fuck, that was a brilliant film.
Yeah, but, I think that's true. War of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, man, I can't wait to see that.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
That's probably my favourite sort of popcorn franchise...
It's weighty, you know, it feels a bit weighty. And it also, what I love about this one is it feels very much like an end to the trilogy. It's like, and that's our franchise done. We don't need to leave it. It's just, it's.
You know, you're completely and utterly fooled if you think that that's what they're doing.
Yeah, there'll be another one.
Yeah. We're never going to remake this ever again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Well, there's one guy in the cinema going, well, that's terribly admirable of them, isn't it? To, like, you know, go, well, there's all that money we could make, but no, this needs to be a trilogy.
Yeah.
I like that.
Ah, they've played me.
Sorry to break
those computer monkeys played me.
Yeah, they played me. I was teary in the second one. I'm like, this is a computer-generated monkey, and I'm upset.
Gets it.
Wow, circus is good. Right, okay, so look, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you and meeting you, actually.
Yeah, you too.
Let's do this again in a few years' time, and we'll talk about the other, the second lot of Apes trilogy. that they'll make inevitably. Let's play out with your second choice of songs. This is Happy Heart by Andy Williams. Why'd you pick this?
This is a song from the end of Shallow Grave.
Right.
So where...
Why did you pause and smirk then?
Because I was trying to work out exactly why I picked it. I suddenly realised I'm not sure.
You haven't thought about it. But just went with a gut feeling, didn't you?
Yeah, I think because I remember... It's that same thing that I was talking about before, of like it being... It's a happy ending, but entirely for the audience, not for any of the characters. So if the film would end so differently with a different song, where everything goes to shit, they've like ruined their lives, and it could fade out some bleak to that Amy Mann song, could fade out to that at the end. But instead, Danny Boyle, in this very theatrical way, goes the other direction. It's like, this is all crazy and life's awful. And it's like for the audience to go, this is, I love this. Okay, I love the fact I've watched this.
Yeah.
And I kind of admired it.
Is the last shot where it's Ewan McGregor with the knife in the floorboard going through his shoulder...
And it pans,
and then he smiles, and it pans down, and
the money's under the thing, and then it cuts to what's the name of the actress?
Kerry Fox.
Yeah, in the car, opening the bag and realizing she's been had, and she's like screaming and crying, and then Happy Heart plays over her crying, which is such a weird juxtaposition of image and audio.
No, I'm sorry, but what an amazing ending to a film,
right?
Well, what a brilliant choice. Thank you, Tom. Good luck with the rest of Ill Behaviour. You're doing it live as well, right?
Yeah, we're doing a stage reading. I'm going to shave my head halfway through.
Good. And yes, good luck with the rest of your career in Wales.
Thanks.
There's a certain sound always follows me.